come. I've heard of these lectures and they all sound very good, and I wish I'd been to many of them, but here I am now with the privilege of speaking to you. And I'm very conscious that there's a big clock behind me as well, but I've got my little clock here. But anyway, now I'm going to begin by reading from the Word of God, Psalm 21. And it's a psalm that is obviously describing the King, our King, our Lord Jesus Christ. But I also know that it was a psalm that was used when time of the Restoration, when Charles II was recalled, and our Presbyterian friends rejoiced to sing this psalm, mistakenly, I think. But there it was. But it is a psalm about kings. So I will apply it tonight to Alfred the Great. Psalm 21. The kings shall joy in thy strength, O Lord, and in thy salvation how greatly shall he rejoice. Thou hast given him his heart's desire, and has not withholden the request of his lips, Selah. For thou preventest him with the blessings of goodness. Thou settest a crown of pure gold on his head. He asked life of thee, and thou gavest it him, even length of days for ever and ever. His glory is great in thy salvation. Honour and majesty hast thou laid upon him. For thou hast made him most blessed for ever. Thou hast made him exceeding glad with thy countenance. For the king trusteth in the Lord, and through the mercy of the Most High he shall not be moved. Thine hand shall find out all thine enemies, thy right hand shall find out those that hate thee. Thou shalt make them as a fiery oven in the time of thine anger. The Lord shall swallow them up in his wrath, and the fire shall devour them. Their fruit shalt thou destroy from the earth, and their seed from among the children of men. For they intended evil against thee. They imagined a mischievous device, which they are not able to perform. Therefore shalt thou make them turn their back, when thou shalt make ready thine arrows upon thy strings against the face of them. Be thou exalted, Lord, in thine own strength. So will we sing and praise thy power. Now, going to think about Alfred the Great, and none of the kings before, or perhaps few of the kings after the Norman Conquest, have been held in such high regard and high renown as Alfred the Great. Certainly none of them have had that title given to them, the Great. There are many stories, as we know, told about Alfred the Great. Everybody here, I'm sure, has heard of him burning the cakes on that particular occasion. And others will no doubt have heard of him going into the camp of the Danes, disguised as a wandering minstrel, so that he might steal their secrets and spy out their plans and so on. We all know about these stories. We don't know whether they're legends. We don't know whether they're true. But someone has said, to get stories like that told about you usually suggests that you're an extraordinary person, that you're a person of quite unique character, a notable individual. And so whether these stories are true or not, they give us some indication of how those in his own day, and many after, have regarded this man, Alfred the Great. He's been called down through the years. I don't know quite when it began, but it seems to have begun from a long time ago, England's darling, and been cherished by our nation. Well, the German historian Leopold von Ranke went so far as to say that Alfred is, or was, one of the greatest figures in the history of the world. One of the greatest figures in the history of the world. Some have called him the Charlemagne of England. And we know that the Emperor Charlemagne, the Holy Roman Emperor, was a man, again, of high renown and great achievements. But some could say, in regard to Alfred the Great, that though he didn't have as wide an influence as the Emperor Charlemagne, yet, in some ways, he had an even more excellent influence than him, because Charlemagne, though he was exceedingly sympathetic to the Christian faith, we might put that in inverted commas, nevertheless, in his own life, his own morals and so on, he wasn't so excellent. But Alfred the Great was certainly a man unblemished in his moral character and his dealings with other people and so on in life. We can go on and say that Alfred the Great was really the real founder of our nation, the English nation. The Anglo-Saxons had never really come together as one people in the way that Alfred eventually brought them together. And we know that his grandson Athelstan, mainly because of the work of Alfred, his grandfather, did eventually achieve the unification of the Anglo-Saxon people. We know of Alfred, of course, because of his strong resistance to the Danes. And again, our nation would have been very different if he had not stood up against these pagan peoples that were at that time invading our country. We know because of his firmness, they didn't succeed. But we know also because of his wisdom, tremendous insight for his day and age. He was able in the end to make peace with the Danes, an honourable peace, having defeated them, nevertheless allowing them to remain here, many of them, and perhaps especially so in that he persuaded them to embrace the Christian faith. We don't know whether that was a nominal conversion or a genuine spiritual conversion of those people, but we would probably say it was a bit of both. But anyway, he achieved that. The Danes then, and this is all introduction, the Danes really had spread far wide in those days in different parts of the continent, as we know. The Danes of Normandy, though, those who settled there and eventually became known as the Normans, when they embraced Christianity, the interesting thing about them is that they took upon themselves a certain missionary zeal. They had travelled farther than we sometimes think, and they had occupied the southern parts of Italy, and they'd certainly driven the Muslims out of Sicily and that part of the world. And they did, as I say, become great defenders of the Western Catholic Church, as everybody in the West was part of in those days. And then also we might say of the Danes, because of what Alfred the Great did in bringing them under the influence of the gospel and to conversion in many cases, then went on to evangelize the Scandinavian countries, Denmark, of course, Sweden, Norway, Iceland, Finland, all those countries were then evangelized. And all this sort of thing was stemming from the life, the testimony, the work, the vision of Alfred the Great. So he's a man of much influence. We might just say that there was a reaction in those Nordic countries at first, after a while, to the Christianization of those countries. They had a king called Sven who tried to reverse what had happened, but then he had a son whom we've all heard of, Canute, King Canute, and he was a very godly king. We sometimes forget that, and he became king not only of the Saxons here in England, but also the Danes. So the King of England was also the King of Denmark, and much good was done. Now, the next thing we might say is this. In this lecture, I feel it's right to say something, not only about Alfred's childhood, but in order to understand him properly, we've got to say something about his father. And not to be here all night, we've also got to say something about his grandfather, because we don't really get the picture until we've looked at them a little bit. So I'm going to do that now, first beginning with his father. And Alfred was the youngest son of King Ethelwulf. Now, you may know that in this period it's tremendously confusing because almost everybody's name begins with the name Ethel, the Ethel age. And you get so many Ethels in this story, they're coming out of your ears. And so I ought to just say something about that. Ethel means an individual of distinction, a special person, a person of high rank and high regard. So when you hear these names, these various Ethels, and they can be men or women, they're people of rank and high regard. But anyway, King Ethelwulf is the father of Alfred, and he, in first place, is married to Osburh, or Osburh, as she's sometimes called. That's his first wife. She died when Alfred was only about 5 years old. Now, Ethelwulf, significantly, was born in France. In fact, he was born in the court of Charlemagne in the city of Arcon, where his father, who we'll come to in a minute, was at that time in exile, but he was being sheltered by the great Charlemagne. So that's going to have an influence on our friend Ethelwulf, as we'll see in a minute. Now, Ethelwulf has been treated somewhat harshly by what you may call modern historians. They describe it like this. They say he was gentle, pious, and indecisive. Gentle, pious, and indecisive. But it seems to me anyway, not just me, but many other people, there's rather a harsh way of describing, unfair way of describing him. I want to say this, he was very much influenced by Swithin. We all know about St. Swithin. Good job it's not St. Swithin's day today, because it'd be raining forevermore. But he seems to have been a good chap, was Swithin. Anyway, he was influenced by him, as was Alfred in later years. Anyway, this man, Ethelwulf, was very godly, was very pious, genuinely so, I believe. It's said that he gave a tithe of his income, a tenth of it he gave to the church, and donated a great deal of money to worthy causes in his day. When Alfred was four years old, his father took him to Rome for a blessing from the Pope. We have to remember that Roman Catholicism hadn't sunk so far into error as it did in subsequent years, so it wasn't a terribly bad thing that happened to him there. By that time, though, but they were in Rome some many months, by that time Alfred's mother had died. And Ethelwulf, on the return, remarried. He married a girl called Judith. And there was some controversy about that because she was very young, but I won't go into all that. But she was the daughter of a man who you will have heard of, Charles the Bald, who was, I don't know, has some unusual names, I know really, but there it was. Charles the Bald, again, the Holy Roman Emperor succeeding Charlemagne. So they had all this sort of influence in their backgrounds. Anyway, though the modern historians say that Ethelwulf was a peaceable man, he was, at the same time, he was a brave warrior and fought some very important battles. The most important one was the Battle of Ethelwulf, which was a fight against the other Saxon kingdom, the Mercians. Where we are now, we're right in the very centre of ancient Mercia. But anyway, there was a battle, and he won. Another battle that he fought was the very first battle that had taken place against the Danes, who were just coming on the scene at that time. So that's a little bit about his father, but one other thing is this. One of the reasons why they went to Rome was not just so that his little son would receive a blessing from the Pope, but he also went there because he was very concerned about the moral and spiritual state of the nation. And he went there, again we wouldn't use these terms today, on a pilgrimage to pray for the nation. So you see the sort of man that he was. Well, as I say any more about him, I don't think I will say any more about him because the time is short. But I'm going to go on and say what happened after his death. Because he was succeeded by various brothers, his own sons, but brothers of Alfred. And this is how we get Alfred onto the throne. Now, not to be tedious, I'll run through these names quickly. Ethelwulf was succeeded by his son, whose name was Ethelbald, no doubt named after Charles the Bald, or whatever, but he was the son. Now, he was completely godless. He did many, many wicked things. I won't go into all the things that he did, but he only reigned for about 3 years, and that was the end of him. He was succeeded by the next son, Ethelbert, who was a very godly man, but really that was the only quality that he had in any distinction. He wasn't an able ruler, he wasn't a brave warrior, he really let everything get out of hand. And you know, when we are godly, we still have our responsibilities and duties on the side of that. It's not just something that we have aside. And under his reign, the Danes really got a very strong foothold into the nation, and really he let them establish themselves here and do whatever they liked. Now, he was then succeeded by the next brother, who was called Ethelred. There is an Ethelred the Unready that comes into history, but that's a few years later. This is a good Ethelred. And this is the man who begins to really attack the Danes. And he is helped in that work by his younger brother, who was Alfred. So we see the situation developing. Now, the Danes had established themselves, I ought to emphasize this, I will get to the Alfred in a minute, in a very powerful, strong way. They'd already overrun the area that we now call Northumbria. The two kings that were in that area, they'd murdered, and they put to death many of the inhabitants. They also destroyed all the work of the missionaries. You may hear of these later if you have a lecture on this period. Oswald and Aidan, they evangelized the area, they'd done tremendous work. But it was all destroyed by the incursions of the Danes at that time. Not only so, the Danes came further south into the area called Deira, which is now Yorkshire. Again, it was murder and destruction, specially vented out in a real purposeful way against the church of our Saviour, Jesus Christ. They came further south on that eastern coast, down into East Anglia, as we call it now. And you may know that there they murdered the king, Edmund, now known as Edmund the Martyr. He was brought before them, as it were, and they wanted him to worship the Norse gods. And as a Christian man, he wouldn't do it. And they apparently tied him to a tree and shot arrows at him. A slow death, but he wouldn't relent. He was faithful, and he died. And the very St. Edmund's Cathedral is supposed to be built on the site. So this was a fierce foe that was strongly opposed to the things of God. Now remember, Alfred's people are based down in Wessex, right down in the south there. And so far, they hadn't had too much trouble from the Danes. But the Danes had got together what they call the Great Army. And they now could see that the Wessex was holding out. And this Great Army, so-called, now began to fasten its attention on that area. Everybody else had succumbed to the power of the Danes. They met Ethelred, And of course his younger brother Alfred at the place called Ashdown on the Surrey and Berkshire Downs, really just outside London in a way. And there was this great battle, the Battle of Ashdown. You could say it was one of the most significant battles in the history of our nation. Remember, no other Saxon king had been able to withstand the power of the Norsemen, the Danes. And people had got to such a state of depression that they thought nobody can stop them. It's a very dangerous thing in life when we think the enemies of God can, you know, surely win and triumph. We mustn't ever think that, because more there are with us than them. And God will win, the great motto of Calvin. So these two men, Ethelred and Alfred, they challenged the Danes there at Ashdown. And wonderfully and remarkably, they won the battle. They won the battle. And so that was a turning of the tide. It is possible, they learned, to defeat the Danes. So that's the background of Alfred, his father and his brothers, all the things that are happening just prior to the point where he becomes king. But I just have to go back a little bit further now to his grandfather for a few minutes. And his grandfather wasn't called Ethel anything. He was in the egg age. He was Egbert, when they all began to be an egg. So with just one G in it. So he was Egbert. Egbert, King of Wessex. Now, he was a very, very powerful and wise man. If anybody would have united all the Saxons, he could have done it. His influence stretched far and wide. Even here into this region, Mercia, he had an influence. And even further afield, up into Northumbria, as we mentioned a few moments ago. He had great influence. He subdued the Welsh, although we say something about the Welsh, how they were very much on the side of Alfred in his day. He conquered Cornwall, and he was tremendously powerful. He was called the Brett Wilder. That was a title that the Saxons had of a king who had influence over all the other kings. And so that was him. Now, at this time, I just mentioned this in passing. In this area, the king was the famous Offa. We've all heard of Offa's Dyke. And what intrigued me about this man Offa is this. He was the first king in English history to give himself or receive the title Defender of the Faith. I'm just telling you this as an aside, really, because I think it's interesting. Offa, in those far off years in the 19th century, had the title the Defender of the Faith. And really, after that, all the Saxon or English kings then had that title. And we know from our history that the Pope gave the title to Henry VIII. Well, the fact is, the English kings already had the title. So I think that's just a little interesting thing about Offa. And not only that, when Offa's son became king, he was anointed. That was significant as well, in the Old Testament style. And that was the beginning, really, in our English history of the king being seen as some kind of a spiritual leader in the country. But anyway, I just mentioned those things in passing. Now, Egbert as well, remember he's the grandfather of Alfred the Great, he had also spent some time on the continent in the court, as we mentioned earlier, of Charlemagne, the Holy Roman Emperor. And we know that Charlemagne's vision was to unite the whole of Europe under a kind of a Christian rule, nations built on the precepts of Christianity and united under this vision of the Holy Roman Empire. Now, we're not really going to say anything of that. But remember that when Alfred comes to be king, he has this vision of uniting all the Saxon tribes under one king in one nation, built upon the precepts of Christianity, a Christian nation, not a Christian England. And it strikes me that's where he got the idea from his father, who had been there on the continent under Charles the Ball, and his grandfather, who had been there under the influence of Charlemagne, and so on. So all these background things are painting a picture for us of Alfred and what his vision was, and how he learnt these lessons. I might say this in passing. We sometimes tell ourselves, and there's a lot of truth in what we do tell ourselves in this, that before the Reformation, in that period, the Middle Ages that we call it, really beginning at this time of Alfred and so on, and going right through to the Reformation, we sometimes can say to ourselves, well, nothing spiritual happened then. You know, it was completely dark, it was a lost age, really, nothing really good ever happened. And we know all about the bad things, and they're there, and we should recognise them. But just pause for a minute and say, well, what were the good things that came out of that age? And I'll just say three of them, just very briefly as we go through. One of them was this: the concept of Christendom. Now, we could criticise that in many ways, but a vision of nations built on the precepts of this book, let's say it like that, unified by the pursuit of Christian ideals and standards, laws and so on, outlook. Now, with all the failures of it and with all the corruption that eventually came into it, nevertheless, we would say, well, there was something good about that. Nowadays, people have the idea of a secular society. Well, they didn't have that, certainly, in those days, the concept of a Christian nation. The second thing that they held to, would be this: the concept of chivalry. Chivalry. You know, the attempts to see the need of self-defense, as far as a nation was concerned, or a people's, or so on, the need for courage, but at the same time, the need for self-restraint, regard for women, for children, for compassion, for justice, for discernment, for humility in our conduct, and so on. The concept of chivalry. You can't say that wasn't a bad thing. And that came out of this period. And then another idea, as we're going to see, particularly illustrated in the life of Alfred, the concept of justice embodied in law, we'll talk about the laws of Alfred soon, grounded in an idea of Christian morality, accessible to all, impartial, discerning, merciful, and so on. These were some of the ideals that were abroad, and which these people that we're talking about now had to do with. So that's all the background. Okay, now we better get to Alfred. Now, he's born Wantage, Berkshire, 849. Wantage, which just looked more like a clearing in a forest in those days, 849. One of the well-known stories about him as a little boy was that his mother, Osberg, read from a book, a picture book. Nobody really knows what the book was. Could have been poetry, could have been Bible story, I don't know what it was. Some worthy book anyway. And she said that the first child that could repeat it, not read it, but repeat what it said, would have it. It was one of those beautiful illuminated manuscripts. And the story is that Alfred, the youngest of them all, that he did it. and he received the book. Modern writers on Alfred Gore, all about him being illiterate and all sorts of things. He certainly wasn't. Anyway, as a young man, growing up, showed himself to be very, very brave. He could handle a spear, he could ride a horse, he could do all this sort of thing, fire a bow and arrow. He was a very outward going and active sort of young man. He liked to listen to the minstrels and the bards of the age, who would repeat the stories of old Saxon history and so on. He was a patriot. He could sing. He learned to play the harp. He could sing and play the harp as well as any minstrel. That was going to come in very useful for him later on when he went into the camp of the Danes. Emily Sarah Holtz, if you've ever heard of her, was a great Victorian writer of English history for children. Get the whole set of her works because they're fantastic. Anyway, she said that the three R's never came into the education of Alfred the Great. You know, reading, writing and arithmetic. No, the system of education that he passed through was really had to do with these three things. To manage a horse, to draw a bow, and to speak the truth. Well, there you are. The last one applies in all ages, doesn't it? To speak the truth, and that's one of the titles that Alfred has, the Alfred the Truth Teller. That's what Emily Holt calls him anyway. So this is the sort of boy he was growing up. Now he had a great thirst for knowledge. A great thirst for knowledge. And whatever he found out, he liked to write down. In the first place, he had to get somebody else to write it down, because he couldn't write at first, but he soon learned. But he had a book, and you know what it was called? A handbook. A handbook, which, oh, well, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? But the thing was, it said that he invented the name. There was no such thing as a handbook till he called his little book for putting all his notes in a handbook. And if you use the word handbook, well, you have to thank Alfred the Great for inventing the word. But it is good to take things down. I can see some people taking notes tonight. Anyway, he used it. He wrote down, or had written down, then wrote down, all kinds of things in it. In those days, it was really only the ladies that bothered learning to read and write. It wasn't considered to be a manly sort of a thing to do. But Alfred wasn't bothered about what people thought. He did learn how to read, and he learned how to write. But he wasn't lacking in love of the outdoor or anything like that. Well, soon this rather idyllic, quiet boyhood that ended, it was shattered, because there came about the need to fight, and that Battle of Ashdown that I was telling you about a few minutes ago suddenly looms, and he has to fight. When he's a young man of 18 in that battle. Another aside. This is an aside, but it's not really an aside, but it cuts across the floor of what I'm saying. The man that we are indebted to for knowing all these things about Alfred, of course, is Asser. Asser was the Welsh bishop whom Alfred had as his advisor, I suppose you could say, and as his chaplain. Just a few minutes ago I was saying that Alfred's ancestors fought the Welsh, but Alfred brought the Welsh on board, and that's another great achievement that he accomplished. Asser was a monk from St. David's in Wales, and he wrote the life of Alfred, and you can still buy it. There aren't many books still in print, and get them in paperback. Doesn't cost very much. Written over 1,000 years ago. You can get the book. Now, the copies that we had of the book weren't many in the first place. They were lost in a fire in the time of the Reformation. But Archbishop Parker, who lived in those times, the 16th century, they say, Archbishop Parker had a big nose, by the way. And you heard that saying, a nosy Parker. Well, that's probably where it came from. But anyway, that's just to keep you awake a bit longer. But but the thing was, before the fire that destroyed the originals of Asser's works, Parker had it all written down, copied out, and so on. And he added some bits to it from other sources, but we're very indebted to Parker. But I say that for another reason. It shows that at the time of the Reformation, there was very great interest and very great admiration for this man, Alfred the Great. So that's an important thing to mention. Now, Alfred was married in 868. I can't give you the actual date, but he married a Mercian princess. So that's a lady from this area, and her name was Ethel Swift. And they married in Gainsborough, by the way. That's where the ceremony took place. They had seven children, and perhaps the most famous of their children was Ethel Fleda, who was called the Lady of the Mercian, and we could say an awful lot about her. Anyway, this decisive battle of Ashdown that launched Alfred into the field of battle, as it were, took place January 871. Here's an interesting thing about that battle. You'll have heard of Winston Churchill, Sir Winston Churchill. In the 1930s, the latter part of the 1930s, he was writing the history of the English-speaking people. You might have a copy of it at home. And around about 1939, he was writing about Alfred the Great. That's where it came to in his unfolding story. And what was he writing about? The Battle of Ellendune, we mentioned a few minutes ago, and it seemed, you know, a very decisive battle. But more especially, the Battle of Ashdown, the battle that everybody thought nobody could win. He was thinking about the Danes, this irresistible force, it seemed, that had come sweeping through the nation, destroying everything in their path, and nobody could stop them. But Alfred and his brother did. Totally outnumbered. Can you see the connection? At the very time he was writing it, there was another fellow, not a Dane, but a German, Adolf Hitler, sweeping through the continent, destroying everything in his path. Nobody could stop him. But evil can be stopped. You know, many giants, great and tall, stalking through the land, headlong to the earth would fall, if met by Daniel's band, or Alfred's band, or whatever band you think. I don't mean a band where they play instruments. You know, sometimes these days you can get mixed up, but you see what I mean. Stand up for the truth, and you're bound in the end to win. So I mention that just as we're going through. Well, anyway, that was the first battle, but the battles were long and hard. There's another interesting thing about that Battle of Ashdown, though. I told you that it took place up in the Berkshire Downs, just outside London, as it were, stretching a point. Because the Danes had occupied London at that time. It wasn't the capital of England, but it was an important place then. And while Alfred was there, sort of watching, keeping his eye on the movements of the Danes, various things came into his mind. You know, if you're on the eve of a battle, and you think, next day I'm going to be there, I may die, anything could happen. And you go over all your life, don't you, and you think deeply, and no doubt he thought, is it well with my soul? Am I right with God? All kinds of important questions that we should all ask whether we're in a battle or not. But one of the things that he remembered whilst he was going over in his mind was that there were people in other parts of the world that were in desperate straits. He'd heard of it. He'd heard of people in the vicinity of Rome who were starving. He'd heard, remarkably, that there were people as far away as India that were starving. It's interesting that they knew about far off places like India even in those days. And he resolved that if he lived, he would try and meet those needs. So you see the sort of breadth of the vision and the concern that this man had. Anyway, we now come to the date AD 871. And as a result of this famous battle, Ethelred received wounds from which he eventually dies. Alfred's other older brothers, whom we haven't mentioned their names, were not really mature enough or fit enough, wise enough, to even be considered to be kings. And so, the Witan of the Mots, that's the old name for the parliament, the assembly of the wise, because they had a great say in who would be the next king. It wasn't necessarily hereditary in those days. The Witan of the Mots said their choice would be Alfred. I don't imagine he wanted the job. I think he was about 22, 23 at this stage of his life. The Danes were gaining ground, even though the Battle of Ashdown had been won. It wasn't a very easy time to be a king. The country was devastated. All manner of ills. Remember, even his father had gone to Rome to confess the sins of the nation. It wasn't an easy time. Anyway, though Alfred didn't want the work, he took it on. Some have tried to imagine how he must have felt as he followed the funeral cortege of his elder brother to Wimborne in Dorset, where he was buried. Think of all the thoughts that went through his mind. And also, people have said, all the great influences and supporters of his earlier life, his father, his mother, Swithin and others, they'd all now gone home to glory. And if ever a man felt alone, it was this young fellow, Alfred, now called to be king. Anyway, by the grace of God, he becomes king. Nobody knows whether he had really had a coronation. Things were so bad, they may have not even bothered to have a coronation. Some think he did have a coronation. Others think he didn't. And I don't know who are right. But there it is. But somebody, Plummer, in the 19th century, put it like this. He said, Plummer said, the fate of England and of Western Europe hung, humanly speaking, on the heart and brain and arm of a young man of 23 years. That, under God, he proved himself equal to his high task, is what has justly earned for him the title the Great. So tremendous weight was now lying upon the shoulders of Alfred the Great. Interestingly, when did Alfred the Great first be called Alfred the Great? And again, people have said, oh, it was much later on that people recognised him to be great. Well, that can't happen. But others say the title was given to him much, much earlier. I've got all the details here, but I won't go into it. But he does seem, almost from the beginning, to have had that title and, received and been recognised as a man of high acclaim. The Danes are very powerful and they attack the Wessex town of Wilton. Guthrum the Dane is now the leader of the Danes. And this man, Guthrum the Dane, could easily have been the nemesis of Alfred the Great. This battle that took place at Wilton
Alfred lost. His first battle as king, he lost. Not a good start. And the Danes really had him hemmed in. But he had an option. Now, you know, Mr. Rudyard Kipling wrote a wonderful poem. If you pay the Dane geld, you'll never get rid of the Dane, which is a good principle in life. Because the Danes had already adopted a system when they were just raiding parties. They'd come to some coastal town and say, look, we're here, we're the Danes, we'll smash the place up unless you pay us gold to go away. And that's very convenient for the Danes. Somebody said to me the other day, those Danes mustn't have had anything to do, must they? You know, why do they come sailing round the coast, breaking everything to pieces? But anyway, they did it. And they adopted this system that you could pay them to go away. What was Alfred to do when he was so outnumbered? Well, what he did was he did pay the Dane geld, in spite of what Mr. Kipling says. He paid them the Dane geld, and they went away for 3 years. But it gave him time to do all the things that were necessary to beat them the next time they came. Now, after that, he never paid the Dane geld, so Kipling is right, really, and that's the best principle. Well, there are times when you have to do something else, and that was part of Alfred. He had a very quick mind, quick thinking, aware situation up. He wasn't conventional in many ways, and that's what he did. Anyway, the Danes went away for a bit, but they came back. One of the next big dangers was they occupied the city of Exeter, and they were really had a very good foothold there. Alfred set off to go and attack them. It's a good job he got there late, because the Danes, and there you see the providence of God in all this, the Danes had a massive reinforcement force coming to Exeter, not the River Exe, by sea. They were coming up the English Channel. And if they'd have got there, then Exeter would have been absolutely impregnable, and Alfred would no doubt have perished as he tried to take the city. But as that relief force, as it were, came up the channel, a tremendous storm blew. We've heard about these storms in English history before. And the whole fleet virtually was destroyed. It said that they lost 5,000 men in that storm. What does that remind you of? The Spanish Armada, of course. He blew with his wind and they were scattered. So it wasn't the first time the wind or the breath of God had saved the nation. It saved Alfred, really. The Danes eventually withdrew from Exeter, but I won't go into all that. But the battle was nowhere near done. It's Christmas. Well, it's Twelfth Night. You know this part of the story, no doubt. 878. And there's been a bit of a lull. And Alfred and his men, his friends, are celebrating Twelfth Night in Chippenham, Wiltshire, when suddenly the Danish force overwhelms them. They're unprepared. And Alfred and his men are scattered. Some of his men even escaped to France. They escaped to different parts of the country. It was an utter defeat, an utter disaster. Alfred was as good as finished. You know that he escaped over into Somerset, into the marshes, Athelney, in those areas there, very marshy and isolated, where he felt he was safe. It was there, of course, that he was supposed to have got down to his last crust, or half a loaf. And he and his wife and some of the children crouching, of course. Well, I don't know whether it really was, but you imagine it was a day like this. I'm giving a bit of poetic license here. It's a miserable day like this, and they're crouching under a bush, and they've got a little bit of a loaf left to eat. And a fellow comes along, beggar, some of the old tales say it was St. Cuthbert, but I don't know that's true. But anyway, this beggar comes along and says, have you got any bread to spare? Alfred, whatever that had, breaks it in half, according to the story, and gives it to him. And his wife says, that's all the bread we've got. And she said, he who could supply 5,000 on loaves and fishes, you know, surely can supply us. That's the sort of man of faith that he was. Anyway, the other story of that is that he did disguise himself as a minstrel and go into the camp of the Danes. Remember, he could sing, he could play, and he did that. And it seems as if he found out their secrets. It was also the time, of course, of the cakes. Forgetting that, but you know that part of the story. Anyway, so Alfred then comes back, and there's a battle, another battle, the Battle of Edington. And this battle, Alfred totally wins. Absolutely, outright defeats the Danes. That's it. And not only that, he captures Guthrum the Dane, his arch enemy. And then you probably know the next bit. He says to Guthrum the Dane in our everyday language, England is a very big country. Well, it's not that big, but he said that. It's mainly covered in forests. There's enough room in this land for you and your people, as well as us. I'm prepared to let you stay here, on one condition. You allow me to send ministers to preach the gospel to you. And after a certain period, a month I think it was, you come back to me and say, tell me whether or not you're prepared to call on Christ to be your saviour. And if you become Christians, you can stay here. Well, you could see how that could be abused. But the whole thing appears to have been done in great sincerity. And you can read of Alfred spending hours with Guthrum the Dane in the church at Alla in Somerset, talking about the things of God, answering the questions this pagan was asking. Eventually the Danes are sent off to East Anglia, and eventually they do. Many of them become Christians. Where we lived in Hadley in Suffolk, in the churchyard there, was buried Guthrum the Dane. There was no stone, nobody knew where he was, but he was there somewhere. And so it was the two peoples coalesced. Now you know, if we had a map, you could almost put a line down the centre of England, putting the east coast around that side, the east, I don't know if I'm east or west here, but that side, the right hand side, and the left hand side, the right hand side was the Danelaw, Danes country. There's a Yorkshire, beyond there and so on, East Anglia. And then to the west, bending over to about the River Mersey there, including this area here where we are, that was the land that eventually came under the jurisdiction of Alfred. So, there was peace. There was peace. Eventually, and I've got to keep my eye on the clock now because that good clock there is racing on by finishing the minute, but I haven't said anything of his achievements yet, so I'm going to have to go like mad now. Where was I? I'm just trying to. Well, they say, I'll just say this. Another one of the great historians of our land, John Richard Green, said that in this peace that Alfred made with Danes and what happened and so on, not only saved England from destruction, not only saved the gospel here in the country, but Green says, in saving England, he saved Western Europe from becoming like a heathen, or becoming a heathen Scandinavian power. And there's a lot in that, really. It was a massive thing that he did. Now, what about some of Alfred's achievements? Well, if you go to Wantage in Berkshire, you see a monument to him there, and it says this on it. Alfred found learning dead, and he restored it. Education neglected, and he revived it. The law powerless, and he gave it force. The church debased, and he raised it. The land ravaged by a fearful enemy, from which he delivered it. Alfred's name shall live as long as mankind respects the past. Well, that summarizes it a little bit. There's another monument down in Winchester, which was Alfred's capital, the capital of England then. Says Alfred, king of the West Saxons, drove the Danish invaders from Wessex. He created fortified centres, of which Winchester, the largest, was his capital. During his reign, the streets in use today were first established. Alfred was the most esteemed of English kings. He encouraged the revival of learning and monastic life, and laid the foundation for a single kingdom of England. Well, his political achievements were mighty, many. He unified the nation. He made peace with the Welsh, as we've said a couple of times as we've gone through. He found the people demoralised. He found the people not really acting in a noble way. You know, when there has been wars and disappointments and famines and disruption, it undermines the moral fibre of people very often. So he had all this to contend with. Wherever he looked, there were ruins, destroyed buildings. The infrastructure of the nation was completely destroyed by all the things that had happened. There was lawlessness and so on, disregard for whatever laws there were. So then you remember the famous dooms of Alfred. Very important how he set up a new system of law, as everybody knows, based on the Ten Commandments and the sayings of our Saviour Jesus Christ. That was a massive thing that we could speak of. There's a wonderful picture, a painting, showing Alfred stood before his Wittenagemot, speaking forth the laws of the nation, based on the scriptures, really. He also knew that if he was going to build a nation, he didn't just have to have right laws, but he needed the right men. The right men. And he had a principle for finding out the right men. He said this: the king's raw material and instruments of rule are a well-peopled land, and that land must be ruled over by, here it is, men of prayer, men of war, and men of work. Men of prayer, war, you know, to defend the land, and work. Prayer, war, work. They could be three good principles for a Christian in the battle of the Christian life, could they not be? And he said, without these tools, we can't do any good whatsoever. So he did appoint men of prayer and work and war. So I'm cutting out bits here. He's very conscious of the passing of time, so he invented the candle clock. So if I go over time, I've really gone against my old friend Alfred the Great. He lifted the morals of the nation by realizing the importance of a good ministry. And you may know that he had a book issued, translated from the Latin, Pastor Pastoralis. It had been compiled by Pope Gregory. They say that he was the last of the good popes and the first of the bad. I won't go into all that. But this book was very good. How to be a good pastor. How to really teach and instruct and encourage and build up a godly people. And he had this issued right through the land. And that did an enormous amount of good. He re-established the monasteries. Again, monasteries in those days, not the dark places we may think of today, but places where people would gain genuine help and so on in so many ways. He set in motion what was called the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which was the history of the nation so far, and it was a chronicle that was to continue for several centuries after Alfred's death. But it is important to know
where the people has come from and who we are and what we're all about, and so on. And some people have said this, somebody said this, I can never read the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle without seeming to hear the voice of King Alfred. So if you want to hear his voice, you can hear it in the words of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. Coming to the end, but he also translated or had translated some very significant books into the English or Saxon tongue. And amongst these would be such titles as this, The History of Orosius. I'm sure you've all read that. The History of Orosius. But what was it about? Well, it was written by this man, Orosius, and what was he seeking to do? By the way, he worked alongside Augustine, Orosius did. He was seeking to show that the world was a much better place since Christianity had come into it than it was before. Well, what a book to put into people's hands. We could do with such a book like that today. The other book that he had translated was Gregory's Dialogues. I've already told you about Gregory, but this was a book of moral and religious stories intent on edifying the readers. So there'd be little tales and stories that would build you up in the things of God. The other one that he had translated was The Consolation of Boethius, or The Consolation of Philosophy. And that was, by the way, when he translated these books, he usually translated them in his own way, and sometimes slightly changed the intention of the original author or whatever. He felt that was, he could do that. I think my wife's telling me I've sort of shut up now, so I better hurry up. But anyway, the translations of Boethius, we could spend another hour talking about that. It's really about the providence of God. And it's really about saying that, you know that line in the Westminster Catechism, man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. That's the sort of idea that it's about. He had the Venerable Bede's Ecclesiastical History translated, the Soliloquies of Augustine of Hippo, and then, perhaps most important, portions of the Scriptures. Some people say he translated the whole Bible, but nobody's ever found it. But he certainly translated the Ten Commandments and portions of Our Lord's sayings, and he began to translate the Psalms, but he only got to about Psalm 50 when he died. But you know, the Psalms, here's a man up against it, with many like David. Here's a man struggling against enormous odds. Can you think of the consolation of the Psalms? And read the Psalms, imagining you're Alfred the Great with all the enemies around you and all the troubles you've got to face. And it puts it into a different light. He said he founded the English Navy, invented the candle clock, we said that. Some have credited him with the founding of Oxford University, though many say he didn't. He sent arms to far off countries. I didn't mention Judea, I didn't mention Palestine, but he sent arms there. He communicated with Elias III, the Patriarch of Jerusalem. He became known as Alfred the Truth Teller, we've said that. He was a fountain of wisdom. He was a human dynamo, and he was. He didn't waste time, and he certainly didn't that. And he had a vision of an educated people. There is a prayer. Do you know the Church of England in fairly recent times? You know how they have these saints' days. Well, apparently they now have one for Alfred the Great. They haven't canonized him or anything, but they have a special day. And I looked up the prayer that they have for the day, and I thought, I was surprised, it's quite good. So I'm going to read that to you now as we come to an end. All gone. Who didst call thy servant Alfred to an earthly throne, that he might advance thy heavenly kingdom, and didst give him zeal for thy church and love for thy people. Grant that we, inspired by his example and prayers, may remain steadfast in the work thou hast given us to do, for the building up of thy reign of love. Through Jesus Christ our Lord, who liveth and reigneth with thee and the Holy Spirit, one God, for ever and ever, world without end. Amen. Well, it's a prayer for all of us, isn't it? God has given us great men and great women over the course of our history, and saved us from many a disaster and many a foe. And these people inspire us to hold fast to that which is good, do they not? As Paul said. And may we, in the strength of God, seek to live lives as far as in us lies, you in your small corner and I in mine, as we think of these great men of the past. May God bless you in all your studies and meetings together. Shall we? Oh, somebody's going to say a word.